Hello there, dear listeners. All month long on the show, we are talking about Star Wars Celebration, the things that make it great, and the people who have helped bring it to life over the past 25 years. One of the coolest parts of Celebration has been the panels focused on Star Wars collecting. These have been in existence since the very first Celebration in Denver in 1999, and it has grown into the Collector's Track, which is absolutely a Celebration institution in its own right. There are panels focused on collecting, there are events for collectors, you can meet and talk with other people about their Star Wars collections, and they even give out collectibles at the panels about collecting. I had to talk to someone about this, and the only person to talk to was Gus Lopez. He has been at the helm of the Collector's Track since the very beginning. He was there at Celebration 1 talking about collecting, and he's an incredible collector in his own right. I had so many questions to flesh out the history of the Collector's Track and kind of talk about why it's so important and such a cool part of Celebration history. So this is a great chat. I really think you're going to enjoy it. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Kara DJ, and you're listening to Into a Larger World, the podcast.
That's good. You've taken your first step into a larger world.
For being here on the show. It's such an honor to have you. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me on.
I am so excited. As I was just telling you, and as everyone knows about me, I kind of have a Celebration obsession. So I'm really excited to dig into the history of the Collector's Track. But before we get to that, I wanted to get a little bit of what your Star Wars story was before 1999. So how did you first find Star Wars? How did it first come to you?
Yeah, great question. So I, like many people who grew up with Star Wars, so, you know, when Star Wars came out in 1977, I became an instant fan. And I wasn't even into that genre of film. It was such a just transformative movie. It changed the whole film industry and merchandising and everything about film. And I was just an instant Star Wars geek. I was absolutely into the films, and there was only one at the time, but the later films as well. But I very early days was into collecting. I had, as a kid, I'd collected things like coins and baseball cards and other things, and Star Wars came out, and it was just a natural thing for collecting. It was like, even the action figures, when they came out a year after the film, it was like, collect the whole set, is how Kenner advertised it. And there were trading cards, which were the first thing I collected. So even from the early days, I was like into it. The merchandise was a big part of it. And so that was sort of my early days of Star Wars, was fandom around, the collectibles, but I also loved seeing the films. I had a VHS tape of each of the first three films. Before they were officially released, actually. And I watched them like over 100 times each. And then I stopped counting after that. It was just getting ridiculous. So I'd seen the film so many times. And then in the early 90s, I started to get back into it. Like many people who sort of grew up with it, I was in my 20s. I had some disposable income finally that I could afford to get the things I missed out on. And I just started, like many people, getting back into it and collecting. And, you know, my collecting hobby grew a lot over those years. And that's what sort of then connects to Celebration. I had in the 90s, it was like, there were, you know, a lot of the people that had grown up with Star Wars were starting to get back into it. So I had built like the first website devoted to Star Wars collecting. I had gotten together a whole bunch of collectors around the world that were starting to dabble into it. And we were communicating over the internet, and we were learning a lot of information. And so it sort of grew from there for me.
So I love that, though, that collecting was with you, like, since pretty much the very beginning. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I try to remind people when we do things like Celebration panels, like, we all started somewhere, right? Like, you know, there was a time when I was a kid collecting the trading cards, and that's all I could find for Star Wars, right? So, like, everybody starts somewhere in their collecting.
That's true. I always wanted to ask this to like a big time collector, because I obviously the world of collecting is like, it's kind of like absurdly huge, even just within Star Wars. Like, yeah, there's so many areas and stuff, and I have such a like archaeological tendency to try to like break fandom history and celebration history into like eras and periods of time. Do you think that collecting can kind of be broken down like that for Star Wars?
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely different areas of focus and genres of collecting. Star Wars collecting is vast. There are poster collectors, and they sort of do their own thing, and they hang out with other poster collectors. There are autograph collectors. There are action figures, obviously huge. Toys in general are huge for Star Wars. I think oftentimes the toy and action figure community believe they're the center of it, but there's actually a lot more to collecting than any one of these categories.
Exactly.
There are people that try to get a whole breadth of stuff, right? There are people that try to collect for one country. There are people that collect for a character. So it really just sort of varies. My view, especially being, you know, fairly advanced collector, is there's no gatekeeping. There are no real rules. Like I try to tell collectors, like, don't let other collectors intimidate you or try to assert this is the way to collect, because there are no rules. In fact, a lot of my early collecting, and partly what's played well for me in my collection, is that I didn't believe in the rules. I broke the rules. I went after stuff I liked and not necessarily what everybody else was collecting. So anyway, collecting is vast. It's very hard to categorize, but there are definitely pockets of collecting. There's autographs and posters. There's the trading card collectors. That's a huge community. There are people, but then there are areas that I loved decades ago that no one cared about at the time that now are huge, like food collectibles and cast and crew collectibles. And then in the last couple decades, I've been getting a lot of original movie props and costumes and things from the films. There's a whole community that collects that. So yeah, it's vast. And and then there are people that break all the rules and span several categories. And you know, there's no, you know, not everyone collects the same way.
Yeah. Do you think you have to specialize, or can you kind of, it just depends on what you're into, right?
Yeah. Well, you do have to specialize, because
yeah, eventually.
I mean, even people like Steve Sansweet and Duncan Jenkins, who have endeavored to put together the most comprehensive collections of the world, and they do have them. They have the biggest collections of the world, and they're really impressive collections, but even they have to make a call on what they, there's just too much stuff. Like, they have to prioritize. Even they have to. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's just natural. There's just so much stuff that's considered collectible for Star Wars. So everybody in some level has to prioritize and figure out what their theme is, what their niche is in collecting.
Definitely. And the collecting community, has that been around as long, do you think? Or has it, like, did it kind of really blossom with that comeback in the 90s? Because I know you could also do timelines, obviously, just of like merchandise lines and releases and Power of the Force, or, you know, whatever it may be. So do you think, when did the like collecting community kind of develop into what it is today, do you think?
Yeah, it's a good question. They evolved a lot. So in the 80s, and I wasn't really actively collecting with with people outside my area at the time, but there were other collectors early on. There was like a company, TKRP, that did catalogs and had the ability for people to write in and connect with other collectors and do ads. And so early on, it was like through magazines and fanzines. And so into the 90s, before a lot of people were on the internet, there was a magazine called Toy Shop that where people connected through Toy Shop magazine, at least the toy collectors, but it had a lot of merchandise that was outside of toys.
Right.
And so people would connect that way, and then they'd connect it like locally, in regionally, in conventions. But one of the, you know, things that, you know, I had a big role in, as did actually a lot of people that put on the collecting track, did is really build a lot of the online community in collecting. Like, we created a Star Wars news group. There was this thing called news groups that they used to exist before like Facebook and before forums on websites. We created that, a specialized one just on collecting. And then we actually then broke that up into vintage collecting and modern collecting. So we then had a few different categories. So yeah, so online community really grew. Really was the mid to late 90s when it really took off, because a lot of people, really didn't even have email addresses in the early 90s, and so it grew sort of from magazines to online by the late 90s.
Yeah, and the Star Wars Collectors Archive, which is the website that you started, it's so good. I use it all the time, and especially for Celebration, because so much of the stuff and the badges and the even just like the handouts are pictured there, and it's stuff that is not easy to find pictures of. So like I found a sheet on there that's the shuttle schedule for Celebration 1, and yeah. I was like, what?
Yeah, no, thank you. Yeah, I mean, the archive was great. Like, it's funny, at the time we created it, people thought I was nuts because it was like, at the time there were like 3 Star Wars fan sites total on like the internet. And so to create one about collecting, people thought that's too narrow. Of course, now there's like hundreds of collecting websites. But, you know, over the years, we tried to showcase the best of the best there. But then Duncan Jenkins and I wrote a book in 2008, to document like basically all the items we knew about. And there were like over 77,000 items at the time that we documented, and it was a pretty big book. So we used that as the basis for the Star Wars Collectors Archive database. Yeah. So a lot of that stuff in there came from our book. And then particularly Duncan has continued to extend it because he goes after all of that stuff. I have some Celebration stuff, but he has a vast amount. And one of the things we were very, if you've used it, you probably can appreciate this. We spent a lot of time on the taxonomy we wanted to use and have event collectibles and Celebration under that, rather than say t-shirts from Celebration in the t-shirt category and, patches in the patch category. We wanted Celebration all together because there are people by our calculation, there were going to be other people that were into Celebration collectibles. And we thought it was a natural way to sort of categorize that stuff.
Yeah, it's such a great site. And so moving into Celebration a little bit, segueing in, what were the like collector events? Cause like for Star Wars events, obviously there was the Starlog event in 1987. Mm-hmm. Were you at that?
I did not go to that. I wasn't aware of it at the time. Had I been, I would have made it my mission to get over there, but I didn't make it to it.
Right. But besides that, it was basically just like a Star Wars presence at like Comic Cons and things like that. Yeah. But did collectors mostly go to like, I guess it would be like comic and toy shows, basically.
Yeah. So, like, you hit the nail on the head. So like big comic conventions like San Diego Comic-Con, I would go every year in the 90s. I'd meet a lot of the big collectors, particularly in the West Coast, would be at that convention. And and there would be dealers that would sell a lot of collectibles there. And there would be panels on collectibles. And especially as Lucasfilm went back into making new merchandise, they started having licensees and Lucasfilm make presentations at Comic-Con. So Comic-Con was a big thing for presentations. And then there were some attempts at like fan run conventions that were smaller, and there were toy shows. Toy shows were at least the place where collectors networked. And I remember, like early in my collecting, like it was like the early 90s. I remember, talking to a bunch of collectors in our area, in the Seattle area, who I kept seeing at shows like for a few years. And I said, why don't we get together like regularly, like instead of just meeting at shows, like we all know each other. And so I created a group in Seattle called Sarlacc, which was the first sort of collecting club in the country. And now they have them in all over the country. There are regional collecting clubs so people can get connected locally. But it was funny because people reacted to me like, what do you want to do? Like, we're just here at the show to buy stuff. I'm like, well, wait, we know each other. We talk to each other. We know each other's names. We should get together. And then it sort of became very natural. And we started doing that. And other people started soon after, like a year or two later, you start to see it pop up around the country, that kind of thing as well.
Yeah, I've seen those come up a lot in my research, like the different collectors clubs. Are they still active, or does it just kind of depend on which one?
Oh yeah. I mean, they're all very, very different. Like some have like formal bylaws and elect officers. Some are more informal, like sort of social get-togethers. Mm-hmm. Some have different emphasis, like vintage toys or crafting, or it just really varies by group. And it's not as centralized as say like the cosplay groups. It's pretty decentralized, but yeah, there's still very active, and in fact, there's new ones coming up all the time. So like,
that's awesome.
A lot of the major areas of the U.S. and outside the U.S., there are quite a few in other countries too.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
All right. So now we're gonna move into celebration.
Yeah.
I have like 300,000 million questions, but I'm gonna narrow it down. So starting in 1999,
yeah.
Or actually, I guess in 1998, in the end of the year, when did you first hear about Celebration One existing?
Yeah, it's hard to pinpoint exactly the date I heard about it. I knew, talking to Steve Sansweet, that about Celebration, I think I might have known before it was officially announced, but I knew it was coming with the release of The Phantom Menace. But yeah, like my involvement in the planning for the first one didn't really actually start till 1999.
Right.
So what happened was I contacted Steve and I asked him, like, I have to say, it was like probably like 2 weeks before Celebration. I said, "What's going on with collecting at Celebration? Is there anything planned? I mean, I know you're a big part of planning a Celebration event." He goes, "There's nothing planned. Do you want to run it?" I was like, "That's not a lot of time to run something." And I said, "Sure, we got to do something. So yes, so I will do it." And it was definitely a bit of an afterthought for that convention, but it was they had arranged Lucasfilm had arranged a stage we could use. It was outdoors, so. You know, there's a lot, of course, and I'm sure you've covered it. Like Celebration One was its own unique thing with the rain and the tents and all that stuff.
Right.
We were in this very small stage that had a roof, but the first day we were supposed to do collecting track had pouring rain, so we didn't even have it the first. I had to cancel all the panels the first day, but it was basically outdoors in the cold and in the rain, and a very small stage and had no AV projection or anything like that. So what I did was I had a vast network of collectors. I knew who a lot of people that were already going to Celebration, and collectors, you know, there were great dealers that showed up at Celebration, and a lot of the collectors stayed at the same hotel to do what we called room sales, which I'm happy to talk about that too. It's
definitely
a big sort of unofficial thing at Celebration, but basically the collectors all stay in the same hotel. And so I knew a lot of collectors were going to it. So I picked speakers and panelists for different topics, and we came up with a schedule. But since we had no AV, we said, like, bring your stuff. You're going to show it to people. And so people brought things to show on the stage. And we did gather when the weather got better and we started to do the presentations. We got at times a small crowd. Like, we had an outside area that were like long lines to a lot of the big stages, and people were like, "What's going on over there?" And so eventually we got like some people to just hang out at the stage and listen to the talks. And it was interesting. I mean, we weren't even in, because it was so last minute, we weren't even in the Celebration program. So people didn't even know about us. They did do a printed thing, like from a photocopier kind of thing, or sort of paper black and white printed thing they gave out at Celebration. And we were in that. But it wasn't really widely publicized, like, and so, but yeah, no, so, but I appreciated that, like, Steve, you know, was, you know, confident in me running it. I did ask Steve, I said, "Hey, I need you to do at least one panel. Like, you're going to be important for a draw to this thing. We're kicking this off." So that was the first Celebration. It was really last minute, but like, you know, a number of the celebrations have been, to some extent, fire drills, never as crazy as that, but like some of them have been, you know, challenges to get together in time.
I could see that. Yeah. I have a screenshot of the, I have the revised program that I got.
Oh, cool.
Today,
okay.
But
yeah, we're in that, and we're not in the official program, but we're in the revised program.
Yeah. And there were some really cool talks that you guys did. You did one about high-end collectibles, custom toys, specific character collectibles, really, really cool stuff. And it's definitely has the spirit of what the collector's track like continued to be. Yeah. And I saw that in there, it was called the collector's conclave.
Yes. Yeah. That was like a term Lucasfilm came up with. I think and I know you had asked this, I think Collecting Track, we may have it, I think we introduced that title. It was either Celebration 4 or 5.
Oh, okay.
But it was later, and the reason for that was that at when we got to the point where it was so popular and successful that it wasn't just the presentations, that it was like this sort of whole almost sub convention within Celebration.
Yes.
And we wanted to have people like, it's a track, like a swim lane, or like a, you know, it's this whole separate part of Celebration that has a lot of things going on more than just panels. So we started to brand it around the track instead of just a stage, or not that, I mean, the stage itself is impressive, like the panels we have, but we wanted to make it clear, because we later on introduced a whole bunch of other stuff, you know, which we can get to and talk about, but we introduced mm-hmm. like a collector's lounge, or sometimes we call the social area, where people could do trades and meet other collectors, meet and greets. And we would do, and we did scavenger hunts. We've continued to do scavenger hunts. We added swag that we gave out. We were, and we should talk about that. We were really one of the first to ever do swag. And I would say we probably influenced a lot of the tradition now that is very common in swag. And I'll talk a little bit, I'm happy to share about that. But we printed programs, and we, you know, like we've done auctions a few times. And so, yeah, I mean, it grew to be something bigger than just a single stage. And so that's why we started calling it a track several celebrations later.
Yeah, that's really cool. Okay, so last things about Celebration 1. Yeah. I wanted to ask, I think it's something that people like forget when they talk about Celebration 1, but it was on April 30th, May 1st, and May 2nd.
Yeah.
May 2nd evening at midnight, the Phantom Menace toys
yes.
went on sale.
Yeah.
Were you still in Denver? Did you go to a Toys R Us?
Yeah, I did go to Toys R Us at midnight. So it was interesting. Yeah, some collectors I knew stayed in Denver that night to do that in mm-hmm. Denver. I flew back to Seattle, and I literally left the airport, went straight to Toys R Us. Didn't even go home.
Right.
I had just came straight from the airport. And the Toys R Us is near the airport. So yeah, and it was mayhem there. But but yeah, I did that. And so a number of people flew home. Some people stayed in Denver for Midnight Madness first.
That's so cool. Yeah. Do you have any other memories about Celebration 1 in general? Like anything that stands out?
Yeah, I mean, there were it was a lot of great memories of it. I mean, it was, you know, I mentioned a little bit about room sales. So the collectors, not every collector, but like a big part of the collecting community started this thing where like all of us were staying at the same hotel, and we all brought stuff to buy, sell, and trade. So we, what we did was, in the evening hours, we would just do deals. Like people would open their rooms and make it known that they have stuff available. And people would have like suitcases open with stuff in there. And actually some of the best stuff to buy at Celebration, not just at Celebration 1, since Celebration 1, have been in room sales. It'd been almost better than you can get anywhere else. And so that's been a tradition that has held at every Celebration. And it's an unofficial event. It's not an officially sanctioned event. And it's not really run by anybody. It's sort of organic. Mm-hmm. You know, the people that have been doing it every year, I remember one year a group of us said, okay, we're going to start room sales at 8:00. And we picked a time so we could go to dinner and come back. And we came back from dinner and saw room sales had already started without us. So it was like, okay, no one really controls room sales. It just happens. But yeah, no, it's continued at every Celebration since Celebration 1. And that was amazing. It was like, the collecting community instantly bonded. And one of the things it also, I think, relates to is like one of the things I really try to convey at every Celebration collecting track is to really have a great experience at Celebration, you need to meet other people at Celebration. And I get it. Like people are shy. They go to this big event. They want to go to like big headlining events and they want to just do their own thing. But like it is a game-changing, rewarding experience when you start to connect with like-minded fans who you then get to know over the years. And there's segments of Celebration where they don't talk to anyone else. And there's segments that are like totally buddies everywhere and they know everybody. And I encourage people like make that shift. Even if you're shy and reluctant to it, we tried to do things in the collecting track over the years where we had like meet and greets and like a kickoff event and just to sort of force people to mingle, like to try to get people to do that, because we felt it's so rewarding. And so even for the first celebration, we were doing that. But like my goal was to get the people that aren't sort of inclined to do that, to get them to just do reach out and try to connect with other people.
Definitely. It's so, it can like literally be life changing. It really can. Absolutely. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you don't get
that.
I know.
Haven't done that. It's hard to understand that, but it changes everything. Then it's like, I'm never going to miss another celebration. I got all these friends all over the country or the world that go to it. I mean, it's really crazy how it just changes the whole thing.
It really does. That's so great. Okay. And then my last question that I have to ask everyone that I meet that was at Celebration One, did you go to the Jar Jar Jam on Saturday night?
I did not go to the Jar Jar Jam. I knew about it, and I did not go. Sadly, I missed the Jar Jar Jam. I was probably like trading collectibles or something.
that's totally fair. It just seems like it was a real crazy scene.
Yeah.
And I'm desperately in search of someone to tell me about it. So I found like two
people. I'll let you know if I come across somebody who
thank you.
Yeah.
Yes. Throw them my way. Okay. So now we're moving forward to Celebration 2.
Yeah.
In 2002, which was for Attack of the Clones, obviously. And it feels like the collector's track started to become more of like what we know today at that point.
Yes.
I know still Celebrations 2 and 3 were like, they were a little bit still on the smaller side. I don't know. But so how did that come up? Like, how did you decide to grow the collector's panels for Celebrations 2 and 3 really, but you know, 2 to start?
Yeah. Yeah. Good question. So it was, and 2 and 3 we were, And four, in each of those, we sort of found our way and sort of developed it. Celebration 2, we tried a bunch of things, some that worked, some that didn't. The big game changer for Celebration 2 was sort of this obvious basic stuff, which was we were indoors instead of outdoors, and we had AV projection so we could do PowerPoint presentations and so on. In all the celebrations, I created the collecting track. I've run the collecting track. Celebration 2, I did. I co-ran it with Lisa Stevens, who was the president of the fan club.
Yes.
Shortly after that, she became president of the fan club, and when her company Paizo was running the fan club. So we collaborated on Celebration 2, and then Celebration 3 on, I led Celebration.
Yes.
And in Celebration 2, we tried some things. We tried an auction, which had some amazing pieces. It's just a lot of them didn't sell, but. With the interesting thing about Celebration 2, they gave us a huge room. I mean, it was like, I want to say it sat like probably 2,000 people. Like it was massive.
That's big.
Room. And we were not ready to fill a room that size, right? And it was funny because, you know, in a place like in Indianapolis, like people are constantly looking for a place to sit. So some people would figure out, oh, your room has all these empty seats because, you know, so we'd have people that would come change babies while someone was doing a panel on like posters or something. So it became like the baby changing room in addition to, I mean, we would get hundreds of people for some of the panels and it might be high dozens of people for some of the smaller panels, but it was great. I mean, it was the first time we had an indoor thing. We could plan the speakers. I did a lot of work on identifying the speakers and topics. And then Celebration 3, we were back in the same room. And Celebration 3 was like, you know, we're starting to get word out about the collecting track. We're starting to kind of, you know, build a community around it. And Celebration 3 is where we introduced swag. What one of the concepts I came up with was, let's do a trading card set and give out a trading card at every panel. And then have a checklist trading card also that we give out. And then you have to go to every panel to get the full set. And at the end of Celebration, we'll just give out the extras we have. And so it was relatively easy to put together. We worked with collectors to get photos and on graphic design and then the printing cost. And what I did in that was I said, okay, well, a trading card set's affordable. I have a budget. There was a small nominal budget for a celebration like the people running the show always have provided. And it was enough to cover the creation of a trading card set, which isn't super expensive to do. And mind you, now it sounds like trivial to have a trading card set, but at the time, nobody had anything like that. I mean, it was to have a unique, and it was a Lucasfilm approved collectible. I mean, we had to go through Lucasfilm approvals for it. I mean, it was cool to have something that the collecting track did that's actually an official item. And so we gave those out, and they were super popular. Also, the folks at Lucasfilm had told me that that they had found all these Droids and Ewoks animation cells, just boxes and boxes of them. And they're mostly Ewoks, very little droids, but there was droid stuff in there too. And they just said, could you give them away at your panels? And I said, yeah, we can totally do that. But there were so many.
Oh my God.
Actually had a hard time actually trying to give them. There were so many. It was like hard to get. We finally did give all of them out, but it got to the point where people were just taking bundles of like animation cells. There were so many cells. But they had these extras. They had been giving them out through like Star Wars Insider and other things, but they just had these extras. So we just gave them all out, and it was another kind of swag we had. And those were very popular as well. That was Celebration 3, where was really we really got into the swag stuff. And then on Celebration 4, we took it. I'm happy to talk about that. That also took it to a new level.
So. Definitely. I wanted to say that in Celebration 2, well, first of all, I thought that you would appreciate this. I found on StarWars.com, March 1st, 2002, they announced the auction, and they called it a classy, exhilarating, real-life Star Wars auction experience. I liked the use of the word classy. I thought that was cool.
David Gall, who's actually a professional auctioneer, you know, do it.
That's so cool.
We did try to make it classy, and there was some amazing stuff at that auction.
It's cool because in the little announcement article, they were like comparing it to, I guess eBay was like still pretty new and fresh. So they were like comparing it to that kind of online auction. It's like, well, this is going to be in person. You can see the stuff and you can see the people. So that was really cool. And also, is Celebration 2 where you started the collectibles roadshow?
Yeah, we've done. I'm trying to think if we did one before that. I may have done roadshows at other conventions before that, but the concept of roadshows from like Antiques Roadshow, people had done at conventions, but that may be the first time it was ever done for Star Wars. I don't know for sure, but we've done since that was the first time we did it was there. And it's a fun format because the people who aren't familiar with it, it's where people bring their stuff that they don't know what it is, or they want more information about. And you have a panel of experts that give their opinion on the piece. We've done that at several celebrations.
Yeah. That's really, really cool. And something that I really like about the collector's track in general is that, yes, there's like, well, I guess we'll get to this when we talk about the panel. So hold that thought.
All right.
so also at Star Wars 3 or at Celebration 3, I saw that people could bring their collections. Was it just like encouraging people to just like bring stuff?
I'm trying to remember. Yeah. Specifically we did try to encourage people to, you know, for the roadshow,
right.
We do want people we want them to come up to the stage and show us the piece. So we did encourage that. And then we also encouraged people to bring things to buy, sell, and trade, but it was sort of unofficial. It wasn't until a few celebrations later that after the success of room sales, we introduced also an official event, the swap meet, where we sort of carved a niche between room sales and the dealer room in Celebration to do an official event. But the idea was you can bring one box of items to buy, sell, and trade. But we wanted to be careful that we didn't want to step on the toes of the exhibitor hall where people are paying for tables and have vast amounts of stuff to sell. And we didn't want to step on the toes of room sales, which was a fun sort of organic fan and collector event. But we wanted to have something that got more publicity. So the swap meets have been super successful. And so we continue that tradition and people bring a lot of stuff to, and there's some great stuff at the swap meets too.
I went to the one in Anaheim in 2022 and it was like, it was really cool.
mom too. There's a lot of people.
There was a lot of people. It was awesome though. Okay. So let's move into panels and panels over the years. What I was going to say before was that I love that, of course, there's going to be a rocket firing Boba Fett panel. Of course, there's going to be like a Kenner panel and stuff like that. But then there will also be panels about, I saw sports collectibles. Obviously, yeah. I know yeah. cereal boxes, I think, is yeah. one of your specialties. And then there was one about holiday special collectibles and yeah. things like that. So how have the panels kind of grown and changed as the collector's track has changed?
Yeah, it's a good question. The panels have evolved a bit. Sometimes there's, when I plan celebration, there's a theme. Not that the panels have to fit the theme, but mm-hmm. we want to focus on something. So for example, Celebration Europe, the one we've done that in Germany and UK, we really want to cover heavy international, coverage. So in those events, we had international panels, and we would also have panels and presentations on specific countries, because we really wanted to emphasize the international aspect of Star Wars, especially when we were doing it outside the U.S. And in Japan, we did a similar thing there. About half the panels in Japan were, about Japanese collectibles, and then the other half or so were just things that are popular worldwide. But there are other times that there are, we had themes like, and sometimes these themes were never really announced. They were sort of my intentions in how to craft, the way we did it. But like the last, celebration, in the U.S. in Anaheim, I really focused on, community, trying to get people to connect with each other. And a little bit in London, we focus on this is like, so really try to encourage people. And so one way you do that through panels is you emphasize just a wide range of demographics of the types of collectors of different ages and backgrounds and so on. And then also a wide range of collectibles. And that's a theme I've always tried to do every time is not have it just be the action figure panel, the action figure stage. I want it to be like a whole range of types of collectibles. And I want things for beginners, but I also don't want us to be shy about really advanced topics. Like, it's fine to have a few topics that some people might not be interested in, or you might lose some of the audience in, because the diehard fans and collectors will love those topics. And so the process usually is, it's a bit more or less the same. And over the years, a bit more structured we do a call for panels, and we announce like, hey, we're going to take panel submissions from this date to this date. And people send in their suggestions. And then, we collect a lot of information too, like, have they presented at other conventions? Who are the other panelists? What's your experience in, on this subject matter? Because, a lot of times if it's a person I don't know, I have no idea if it's a good presenter who knows the subject, or I don't know, it's hard to tell. And sometimes we just pick panels. Like, sometimes we have like a great speaker that we want to have them do a topic. But I would say those are usually on a typical celebration, there might be three or four panels like that. Mm-hmm. I say, okay, I want to do an international panel, and I'll contact a bunch of people in different countries to do a panel. But most of them are fan submitted. Mm-hmm. And then I go through a process of evaluating them, and I pick the lineup of panels that I want to use. And then I submit those to Lucasfilm to review them. And they will often have feedback, not dramatic changes, but there's some things that they might want to change. And then I announce to the presenters that I selected them. And it's super competitive. Like, I mean, some years it's like, I want to say like 15% of submissions get accepted. I mean, so it's unfortunately, I'm in a position to have to disappoint a lot of people who want to do a panel because there's just too many great. I mean, really, I always have to turn away great panels. Like, I've never had a problem of like trying to fill the collecting track panels. Like, there are great topics we have to pass on. And then what I do is the next time, I rotate it. There's some things we bring back often, and then there's some things that we try to change, and maybe we'll bring back three or four celebrations later, but so it varies.
Yeah. That's like really, it's a good problem to have.
It's a good problem to have. Yes. And it's funny because one thing I would want to touch on is over the years I've presented at various stages at Celebration, and the collecting track stages have grown. They've varied. Like, the last couple of celebrations have been fairly small stages based on the size of the venues. But we've had rooms as big as never as big as in Indianapolis, but we got to a place where we got to like rooms that sat like 400 people, and we filled the room, and we had lines out the door. I mean, one of the amazing things about Celebration, and years later, people at Reed and Lucasfilm told me this, they said that, you know, it's probably one of the most loved things at Celebration is the collecting track. You have a line out the door, you fill the room every time, and people love it. I mean, and you know, Celebration, you have a mix of stuff. You have things that people love and then things people have had issues with and stuff. But I'm impressed that we've gotten it to this place where we can fill the room pretty much any topic. I mean, there's sometimes a few empty seats, but there's never like the early days where we had too big of a room. Like, we pack it in every time, and we have a line at the door. And unfortunately, we have to turn some people away. If they don't get there early, they might not be able to get into a panel.
Right.
And I've spoken on other stages, and some of those big stages, like, yes, you have the capacity. And I've been in some presentations with a lot of people, but some of the other places Celebration do not fill the rooms. Like, you know, just
it's true.
And certainly the big headliners always fill the rooms, but right, but a lot of the smaller fan panels not fill the room. Collecting track, we always fill the room. So, or close to it. So, so I'm proud of that we've gotten to a place that it's something people love. And it's well known, and people really, really want to see it. So anyway, that took several celebrations to get to that point.
Right. Another thing I love, I don't know if you do this as much now, but it's something that I saw looking back over the schedules over the years, was that as much as there were panels about like the collectibles themselves, there was also just panels about collecting, like
yes,
how to maintain your collection, yeah, or there was one about like social media for collectors and stuff. And I think it encourages such a sense of community, like you said, to do yeah, stuff like that. And just to feel like, even if you weren't at a panel like that, if you had a question about like how to clean something, like you could probably find someone who could help you figure out how to clean it, you know?
Yeah, totally. And those panels are very important. And I would argue maybe even more important than the ones that delve into a subject. You know, the show and tell subjects where someone goes into a category or to what do they collect, they can be great panels, but they can show there's a lot of great eye candy for attendees, like, oh, look at that amazing thing, you know, like you can really impress people with that stuff. But a lot of times and those panels can be great, they can be informative, but they actually can be tougher to present, because you don't just, I think sometimes you can bore people with a slideshow of really cool stuff. This has happened a few times where we get a collector very excited about their category, and they come with 100 slides about this thing they care a lot about. You're like, you're going to lose an audience with 100 slides of anything. And so you need to insert, well, how do one collect it? What's the thing to watch out for in this kind of collection? How do you get started? Yeah. You want to, even if you're going to cover a subject like, you know, I'll say like, you know, school supplies, collectibles, you want to explain to people, why do you love this? What's interesting about it? And so I try to coach presenters that if you're going to present on a show and tell thing, you got to insert that stuff. And we review their slides before we do a pass all over all the presentations to give feedback on them before. And we encourage people to rehearse their presentation, especially if they haven't done a lot of public speaking.
Yeah, that's really, it just adds another like personal element to it that I think makes it so special, you know?
Yeah, I agree.
All right, so now we'll move into the swag. Yeah. So like you said, the trading cards were the first thing at Celebration 3. I think it's just so, it like makes perfect sense. Like, these are panels about collecting, and now there's something that you can collect at the panels about collecting. Yeah. It's like catnip. It just makes perfect sense. And they've become really like a thing, you know? Yeah. So it was the trading cards, and then Celebration 4 were the first medallions, the
correct
coins.
Yeah. And, right, and the quick background on that was, and again, this is an era when people didn't do swag. It was just not done. And we wanted to have something that was just amazing. Like, not only give away something in the panels, but top the trading cards, but like something that was amazing. But like, and I love the coins. I've always liked the particularly the coins that came with the action figures, and I really wanted to do coins, but Lucasfilm, you know, had good reasons why they didn't want us to do coins, because there were licensees that were doing coins. So we were like, okay, we're not going to do coins, but we could do something like coins, like big medallions, which were kind of like coins, but not really coins. Mm. And so the trick with something like that is, well, how are you going to fund it? I mean, we had a nominal budget to cover the trading cards at Celebration 3, but like, coins, a production run of coins, especially if we're going to do one for every panel, is going to be like thousands or tens of thousands of dollars to do that. It's very expensive to do it. And so I came up with this idea that was like, well, what if we got somebody to sponsor each coin? We put their name on the coin and we gave them, they got several sets of the coins. We'd also make special sets for them. So they'd get some cool stuff out of it. But they would be basically paying for everybody's free swag. I mean, and that's, you know, and then I was like, well, we'll see if Lucasfilm goes for this. And they loved it. They loved the idea. They said, this is great. And there were guidelines on it, but basically it wasn't like corporate sponsorship. It was individuals. It was other collectors. And so I came up with this idea of how we would fund this. And then at this stage, especially with Celebration 4, we're starting to get at a really big scale. So that's when I sort of formalized having a team of people that sort of helped me in different celebrations. And so Chris Dragoulias wanted to lead the giveaways. And so he led it for Celebration 4, and he did a lot of the very hard work working with, you know, vendors, working with graphic designers, working with all the sponsors to do that. And so Chris has led the giveaways since Celebration 4. He's led it every year since Celebration 4. And I told him, look, we got this medallion, you know, we worked on the medallion idea. And then I said, there's a way we can fund this. And that was game changing for us. Cause now, you know, the giveaways cost us pretty much since Celebration 4, tens of thousands of dollars. We have to raise tens of thousands of dollars to fund this whole thing.
Yeah.
It's expensive because you're giving out, right. You're like in some cases we've had 20 panels. In the case of Celebration 4, we had 12 panels. And we had 12 medallions, so we gave one at each. I think we had 12 panels. I'm trying to remember, but we gave I think one at each panel, and so you know you have to create hundreds of these very high quality items. So, but we've been running with that model since then, where we have a different collector sponsor each giveaway at every panel, and they get some perks out of it. We actually now are in a place where we have a waiting list of people. Like we have to turn away sponsors. Like it isn't actually hard for us to get sponsors because everybody, like people really, really want to sponsor the giveaways that we've done. But this is way before people were doing swag, and it was at Celebration 4, it was crazy. I mean, it was like no one had ever done it before, and word got out, and it was like one of the coolest things at Celebration 4 that you could buy or get for free anything at Celebration 4. So we had lines out the door, and we were, you know, looking back, we were pretty naive about stuff. Like we ran the panels back to back, and we had never faced the problem up till then of how are we going to get everyone out of the room? Because when you're giving something away, people, you get a crowd and people don't get out quickly. So you have to give.
Right.
And how do we get people back into the room when they're lined up and there's more people lined up than capacity?
It was
after Celebration 4 that we started to introduce pretty big buffers between our panels because we had underestimated the popularity. And, you know, and I would say, and I know based on data that, you know, our panels are popular even when we don't have giveaways, but the giveaways do boost some attendance, but we don't do it just to pack the room. I mean, we do have a lot of good topics. And so anyway, but it was nice. It was nice to, you know, watch a topic and get this really cool thing. And so we've continued that tradition since then.
And so, and then Celebration 5 were mini cereal boxes. That was something that happened.
Yeah. Right? So yeah, what we did was, even before Celebration 5, so Celebration 4, we did medallions, and then we went to Celebration Europe in London. Was in July. So we did like two celebrations in 2007.
Oh my
so that
gosh.
Was kind of crazy.
I forget they were that close together.
It was, I mean, that was nuts to do two celebrations so close together. But we had Celebration 4 was just this game changing thing for us. It was so popular and all that. And it gave us a lot of cred for, you know, things we wanted to do. So we were going to do medallions again. So we did Still, we did toy-themed medallions, but they were based on European toys, and we had logos from different European countries. So there's a medallion set for Europe. And then a year later, we went to Celebration Japan. We did the same thing. We did a Japanese-themed medallion. So there are three medallion sets we did for Europe and Japan in 2007, 2008. And then, yeah, and then Celebration 5, we did the cereal boxes, which were a lot of fun to do. It was like we did parodies of well-known cereal brands, and we had like a full set, and we found a vendor that could make custom cereal boxes for us. So that was that was a blast doing that. I'm a cereal collector, so I love the idea.
Definitely.
And so yeah, that was a fun one to do.
That's really cool. And then Star Tots came on the scene.
Yes,
I don't know the year, maybe 2012
or
maybe
around there. Think. Let's see. I have it in my record somewhere.
Around
that time. Yes.
Somewhere.
And,
right.
Yeah.
And that's based on that's based on a Kenner proposed design toy that never went through.
Correct. Yes. So there's this, Kenner had done preschool toys. They had, that in the 70s and 80s, they had this thing called Tree Tots, which were like their preschool toys. And they planned to do Star Wars themed preschool toys in this sort of similar style. And there were a couple iterations at Kenner where they pitched it. The later phase, they called it Star Tots. But they actually made prototypes of Star Tot toys. So I have those. The only finished painted examples of those I have in my collection, they made a land speeder and an X-wing, and they made a painted like Luke, Leia, 3PO, and R2. And they're three dimensional figures, and they're like, you know, the R2 goes into like, you know, the X-wing, and Luke goes in the cockpit. So they're pretty cool. And we wanted to do something that was sort of a nod to vintage Kenner, but based on, you know, the it was kind of a bit more complicated to do three-dimensional, you know, things. And I think Chris came up with the idea of saying, like, what if we did them like two-dimensional and put them on like cards, like action figures. And that's, so we sort of ran with that. And Star Tots, we've done medallions, and Star Tots are probably the things we've done the most, but the Star Tots, we've done so many series of the Star Tots now. And they're super popular. People love those things. We've done like, trays, like display, you know, the store displays for the Kenner figures came in these like trays that have like a backdrop and a bin to hold them all in. And so we've also offered those. So if people collect the whole set. And then one of the things we started to do at all the celebrations since 4 is do all the extras we have at the end. Like we're not taking any of the extras home. We're going to give them all away at the end. And usually we have every single giveaway, we have at least a few examples left. Sometimes we have more of some, depending on how many attended panels, but we always have extras. And so that's always a fun thing at the end, like right after Celebration closes, we will give out all the extra. And so we've organized it over the years to make it much better. Like Tony D'Amato, who runs the volunteers for the collecting track, he lines up people. Like we have, like if we have 20 different Star Tots, we have 20 different people with bins for their character. And then as people come in, they yell out the character they want and we check if they have it. So it's much more organized now, but it's funny because when we first started doing it, it was this sort of like under the radar kind of thing. Like we unofficially did it and we got into trouble, particularly at Celebration Europe in Germany. We didn't get into trouble with the official people running it, but the facilities people were just so angry because they wanted to like shut down Celebration. And here we are giving away stuff and we're still going, you know, and officially Celebration closed 90 minutes ago. And so I still like have PTSD from this German guy who worked in their logistics or whatever, who was like chasing us down, trying to kick us out of there. But anyway, after that, I then always negotiated to make sure it was official that we had blessing to continue to do this because I understand when you run a convention like that, right? Like once the convention closes, security wants to lock it down so that people can move stuff out and they want to get attendees out of there. But we've been getting exceptions to basically say in our area, we're like the only thing left at Celebration. Once it closes, we have permission to do that. Usually for an hour where we'll just give away the stuff and people now know about it and they line up before the last panel ready to do that.
That's so cool. I love that. Well, I have a question.
Yeah.
Quickly. I make a fanzine and I brought it to Anaheim and to London, but somebody traded me and they gave me a coin. It says Star Wars Anaheim 2020. And then it says on the back, you will know it is time to turn the page when you hear R2-D2 beep like this. And it says records and tapes.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. That was...
So is this like a legit collector's track medallion?
No, or... no, this, that one's swag that, some of the...
That somebody made.
Yeah, people made. Okay. Yeah, yeah. And I think they, in 2020, of course, we didn't have a celebration because of COVID, right? And, and so some people had had already done their swag because some of this stuff has a big lead times, but they saved it, till 2022, I guess, was when Anaheim was, and gave it out there. But yes, that wasn't one of our official ones, but, but you can see the quality of swag now. I mean, that's, you know, fan swag, and some of
huge
it, like, people have been smart about it. Like, they've gone, like, that coin, was minted by Osborne Coin, which is one of the two vendors that Kenner used to make the coins. So it's done very close to the style of the vintage Kenner coins.
That's so cool. Okay. So a few general celebration questions that I have.
Yeah.
I have a million, but here's a few. So being on the other side of the event as, like, not quite an attendee, but, like, you know, working in the event and in the collector's realm and everything, how have you seen Celebration change over the years as it's changed production hands from, like, obviously it was Fantastic Media and then it was Wizards of the Coast and then it was the other one and then it was Reed Pop. So how has it, like, grown and changed from your viewpoint?
Reed Pop's done it the most. I mean, it, it's great. I mean, it's definitely professionally run. Like, it's a big convention. I think, you know, they do a very good job of, as we've done a collecting track, but broadly in Celebration, like, learning from things that worked well, didn't work well from past celebrations. They really try to apply it. I think in general, it's, what's great is if when there's continuity, when you have the same people, whether it's, like, you know, someone like Reed, some, not only Reed as a company, Reed Pop as a company, but the people at Reed who've done previous celebrations, that makes things a lot smoother. And people at Lucasfilm who've done previous celebrations. The good thing is that going into Japan for next year, it's sort of the same people at Reed and Lucasfilm, which is great. So you have people that are very experienced with it, that are doing it, which is usually works really well. I mean, I think in general over the years, right, is like, you know, we talked about the early years, like all the things we were going through in the collecting track, they were probably going through as a whole in all of Celebration. And it's just much bigger scale. It's very professionally run now. It's not to say when you put on a show like that, you know, you plan everything, but things happen and you have to be ready for it. But I think in general, it's gone pretty well over the years, and they've really, you know, they've done a great job of figuring out what's worked really well. And let's keep bringing that back as a success thing. And then cutting out things that weren't, didn't really resonate as strongly. But no, I've been impressed with it. I really like working with colleagues at Lucasfilm and Reed. And one of the things, like, I think people really don't realize is, you know, it's not just sort of lip service that it's a fan run event. It really is a fan. I mean, yes, the big stages are done with celebrities and that's run by Lucasfilm. But, like, if you go around and look at droid building and you look at all the stuff going on, cosplay stuff, and, you know, you really, and then the diorama building, and you go around Celebration, it is a fan driven convention at a massive scale. Absolutely. And I challenge people to find an equivalent that really does that in the same way. Like, a lot of them, like, a lot of conventions are very corporate. And then some of them have some fan input, but it's kind of weird. Like, some conventions, like, I would say San Diego Comic-Con, they have a lot of fan panels, but it's and Comic-Con's a great convention, but it's not, like, truly fan-run event like Celebration. So it's impressive. I think most other franchises would just die for an opportunity to have, like, what we have with Celebration.
I think you're right. And then it's also, you think of, like, the Belgian prop builders and then the 501st, like, their areas and Rebel Legion and the Mercs, like, they make those huge areas with photo ops and stuff.
Yeah.
And that's all us, you know, that's all fans.
Yeah, totally. Like, Belgian, group will have like a big TIE fighter they'll make, or they're, and they had like, I think it was Celebration Japan had the Dewback that was the, I mean, people have done impressive things. And then you have the tattoo section, which Shane Turgeon created, you know, and started that. And now it's continued since then. I mean, that's all fan driven. It's not like, you know, some top down, like, and it's really impressive. And I think people really appreciate how fan driven Celebration is. And the collection track is a little different though than the other sections in that we do have a lot of autonomy, and they do too. They run their own show, but like we, I mean, we pick all the panels. We have our own volunteers. So a lot of times there are, because we've been successful at it, it's allowed us to get a lot of latitude that I think others haven't gotten yet. But we, you know, we run everything for our thing. But the rest of the stages and the rest of the areas, it's all fan driven, and it's pretty impressive.
It is, and on the other stages too, those panels you'll see, it's like it's in the same spirit of Collector's Track of like. Like I hosted a panel on the university stage in London. It was like one of the best moments of my life. But like these like really specific panels, you know, that are just it's just what makes Celebration great. You know, it's just one of those things.
I agree. Yeah.
Definitely. And then what was my next question? Oh yes. So you are someone who has been to every Celebration. Is this true?
Yes, that's right.
Oh my God. Yeah. That's incredible. Yeah. Okay. So
I've done the collecting track in every Celebration.
Right. Exactly. No. So after attending all of the Celebrations, what about it still gets you like hyped and excited as a new one approaches?
Yeah. It's different things. I mean, I enjoy it. Basic level, it's my chance to get together with friends that I don't see, you know, I only see like once a year or once every 2 years. You know, there's always a lot of things I'm looking forward to at Celebration. As a collector, I love hitting the dealer room and seeing what's available for sale or the room sales. I always look forward to the collecting track, like what excitement are we going to generate? How many, you know, are we going to get a lot of people? You know, all those kinds of things. There's always something else, and particularly the ones that are foreign to the US. So outside the US Celebrations, I especially love those because those always are much more exotic to me because, just the types of things that surface at those places, just way more interesting to me, you know, than sort of US, in collecting. Every Celebration, I'm like excited about a lot of stuff going on. Like I think a lot of people who attend Celebration have this same first class problem, which is there's so much to do at Celebration and so many things that you actually have to decide what you're not going to do.
Exactly.
To be able to get, you know, like, and you have to like prune things you would love to do, but you don't have time to do. And so that's always my experience at Celebration. I never get to do everything I want to do. There's so many things. I want to hit the Celebration store and find out what they have. You know, I like to go to the panels with the big premieres, you know, where they're announcing things for the upcoming films. It's sometimes very difficult running the collecting track and doing that, but I have gotten to some of them. So things like that. I always look forward to it though. It's always amazing.
It's true. I think it was at Celebration 2 at the opening ceremonies. Steve Sansweet said that you'll have to clone yourself to be able to do it all.
Good way to put it. Yes.
And even then you might not be able to. Okay. Next question. If you can't answer this, it's okay. But do you think that we'll see some crazy plans for the 50th anniversary in 2027?
I don't know. I don't know anything official at all.
Okay.
So anything I say about it is a completely unofficial. I haven't even broached the subject with people at Lucasfilm or Reed.
Yeah, I'm sure there's just focused on
Japan. They're focused on Japan. So it hasn't even come up. But if I were to bet, I would bet they have to do a big Celebration for the 50th anniversary. I mean, it would seem crazy not to, right? Like, I think they're going to do something. But I've not heard anything unofficial or official about plans to do it. But I would guess that they're going to do it. I mean, they've been keeping on a clip of doing Celebration every 1 to 2 years. It's done a great job of, even in the Disney era, of continued, you know, because, you know, there was a valid question of would that continue, because Disney has their own events like D23 that they run.
That's true.
They run in detail, and Celebration's a very different event. It's a very fan-driven event. but it's continued nicely into the Disney years. And so I would suspect that, I would guess that they were going to do something for the 50th, but I have heard nothing on it so far.
Right. Yeah. I hope so. And I'm so excited to like watch Japan from afar. I'm not going to be able to financially swing it, but I'll be watching every minute that I can.
Yeah.
But I'm very excited for it to come back.
Yeah. Yeah. I would guess it would be in the US for the 50th. It seems like a safe bet, but who knows what.
I mean, we shall see. Yeah.
Maybe they'll have too much to do that year. I don't know, but I'm sure they're going to plan a lot for the 50th anniversary.
I can't wait.
Yeah.
If there's a collector out there listening that wants to propose a panel, I think you've kind of covered this, but like, what do you look for? Or what advice would you give to someone who wants to propose a panel?
Yeah. Great question. I would suggest, first of all, like it's best if they've attended some of the panels in the past to get a flavor for what they're like. But if short of that, actually a lot of the panels we've done in the past are on YouTube. You can see them. I think to understand, and you don't have to do a clone of the other types of panels, but it gives you an idea of the wide range and the types of things. You know, the types of things that help make a case for doing a panel are, is it a subject matter that the person knows? Is the person comfortable in front of large audiences? Have they done presentations? I try to advise people, like one of the things that happens oftentimes, I try to steer people away from, sometimes like people want to present a slideshow on some topic and they want to do it with all their buddies. So you'll have this like six people presenting one slideshow on a thing. And my advice to people is if you've got a subject you're covering, you're probably best off having one or two people just cover it. Panels with six people or so are best for topics that you debate and contrast and where there's controversy or whether like, and so, I try to invite, like I see as a negative when somebody presents like slides on a subject and then has like six presenters. Cause I just go, that's going to be all over the place. Like it's, and we've had them, but it's harder. Right. And I really coach those panelists. Like you really need to be tight on this. And it's very hard to manage time in that situation. But if it's if you've divvied up the slides, if there's a subject, you know, and there's going to be some debate and some Q&A with the audience, great. It can be great. But I mean, I would say, you know, like when you submit a panel, put down all the background, like, you know, if you've done panels before, if the person's a teacher and gets in front of an audience all the time, you know, those kinds of things are helpful because it helps us, especially when I don't know the person, it helps evaluate. And I do always pick people who've never presented before, never presented at Celebration. There's always a few new ones. We don't do the whole lineup that way because that would be pretty risky. But but we do try some new things. I especially encourage people to think of intriguing new subjects because a lot of people submit things we've done over and over again, but I'm much more intrigued when it's a new topic, when it's something out of the blue. I'm like, that would be interesting. We've never done that. Like those are always way, way more appealing to me.
I feel like that's really good advice. I hope someone who's listening will put one out there, you know?
And they can always ask me questions. I mean, when I start posting the call for panels and so on, and also when Lucasfilm and Reed announced the panel submission process, and the collecting track is part of that, so it's at the same timing, there's always a way to contact us if there are questions.
That's awesome. Well, Gus, I think that's all I have. I mean, I'm sure I have more questions that I'm just forgetting. I'll probably email you at some point. But
yeah, sure.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. Is there anything that you want to plug, or should we just tell everybody to go to the Facebook group, or what's the best place to find
We have a Collecting Track Facebook group that will certainly keep everybody updated there. And all the Collecting Track stuff will be announced on the official site and all the official emails that go out, all that. I have been already working with Reed and Lucasfilm on planning for Japan. It's going to be several months before we start doing the call for panelists and all that. We're not ready yet to get those. It's too early to get those, but we'll have a better idea soon of like how many panels we'll you know, accept and so on. But yeah, just stay tuned. As always, like we're always available, and the Facebook group is super helpful for getting information about it, and people can ask questions there as well.
Amazing. Thank you again so much for talking with me today.
Yeah. Thanks, Cara. No, thanks for having me on.
Into a Larger World, the podcast, created and hosted by Kara DJ and produced by me, Travis Bryant, at Forstein. Follow the show on Instagram at Into a Larger World Project and support the show on Patreon at patreon.com/IntoALargerWorld. Have a Star Wars fandom story to tell? Send an email to IntoALargerWorldProject@gmail.com and you could be featured on an upcoming episode. Subscribe, rate, and review everywhere you listen to podcasts. Until we meet again, may the Force be with you.